Hailing Frequencies Open, and welcome to Enterprising Individuals, the Star Trek discussion podcast that boldly goes into excruciating detail about the series, characters, and stories of the Star Trek universe. I'm your host, Aaron Coker, a.k.a. Caliban, and I've waited my whole life for someone to tell me that I'm a pretty mannequin in a fancy uniform. You're a lucky guy, Riker. I'm joined on this episode by Sasha Wood. Sasha is the host of the YouTube channel Casually Comics, where she talks about comic books and comic storylines new and old. Sasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here to talk Trek. It's not something that comes up all the time on my channel, so I'm excited to be able to dive into it.
Yeah, I'm excited too, and permission to come aboard granted. Today we'll be talking about Hollow Pursuits, the 21st episode of the third season of Star Trek The Next Generation. The characters we see on Star Trek often seem like an entirely different species of human. They're supermen and women in perfect health, who never flunk a test, never back down from a challenge, and never miss their Friday night string quartet performance. To be fair, they've got universal healthcare, the knowledge and science of a thousand worlds, and they never have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, all of which would be killer self-esteem boosters in the 21st century. But even in the paradise of the 24th, there will still be some people that, for whatever reason, feel out of place, who still don't know how to start a conversation and still find themselves on the outside looking in. And that may be the most human thing about this fictional universe. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. First, Sasha, it's great to have you on the show. I always ask first-time guests how they first discovered Star Trek. How did you become a Star Trek fan?
I think it goes back to my dad. It was, my mom worked nights, and so one of the things we liked to do together was stay up late, but he still wanted to watch the things that he wanted to watch. And so one of those things that we could watch together was Star Trek. He actually had a tape that he had taped off of the television. And it consisted of almost the entire first season of TNG. So I just watched that tape with him over and over and over again. I think the first episode I ever saw was Too Short a Season. So I have very fond recollections of that episode. I know some people have harsh things to say about the first season, but I have a soft spot for it. So
that's the one with the really sweaty Admiral guy, right?
Yes.
Yes. A lot of kids today will never know as a kid, you don't have a lot of money and a lot of VHS tapes, but having like your stack of VHS tapes and you've taped over the little thing that allows you to record with some scotch tape and you've got, you know, maybe the first season of TNG or the second season. I had a couple of VHS tapes that had select episodes from the first and second season that I watched over and over and over again. And this is a third season episode, but this is one of those episodes that that I knew very well and like really got me into the TNG universe. Mm-hmm. I have to say, just switching gears, that I really enjoy your channel, Casually Comics, and also your videos. And as a comic fan, I try to watch comic videos on YouTube. I don't read as many comics as I used to, so oftentimes I use comic videos as a way to keep up on what's going on in comics. But so many comic channels, they're really dry, or their videos are so long, and they're talking about all these things. And I love that your videos are informative, and they go deep, and they're funny, and they're well-produced and digestible.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I love comics, and I just love talking about them. And I think that's kind of how it started. Just, I don't have a lot of people to talk to them about in my real life. And I'm tired of bothering, you know, the people close to me with plots they don't care about. So I'm like, this is perfect. This is a way for people who care to talk about it.
I can completely understand that. And you have a background in editing and video production, don't you?
I do. Yeah, I started off my career actually as a wedding editor. I used to edit all kinds of weddings, and it was fun. I kind of miss it sometimes, but I ended up falling into the YouTube world in a post-production way and eventually just fell in love with it and started doing my own videos.
Yeah, that really comes through in your videos because they're really well produced. And your output is insane. I mean, you're doing multiple videos a week, you know, writing, editing, shooting, reading the comics that you're talking about. I don't know how you do it.
It helps that I love it so much.
Yeah, I would have to, yeah.
It doesn't feel like work, so.
How did you get started in YouTube? Did you always know that you wanted to produce videos for YouTube?
I started in YouTube for fun. Actually, YouTube got me my first job, funnily enough. In high school, I started just going on YouTube because it was the thing that you did. And I was watching all of these fan videos that people make, like fan edits to music. And one day I just had the realization, wait, I have Windows Movie Maker. I can do this. And so I went on and made my first video was actually a Star Trek fan video video. It was a Ryker Troy fan video to the song "Am I the Same Girl" by Breakout Sisters, Swing Out Sisters, or something. And it was the first video I ever made, and I just kept making videos from that point. And when I was applying for jobs later on, they were in my portfolio, and they were what I used as a highlight reel to get a job working in weddings. So,
wow. That's really great. So listen up, kids out there. It really does work. making videos for fun is not a waste of time. It can get you a job. One thing that I love about Casually Comics is you're not just talking about current comics or doing, you know, the millionth review of The Dark Knight Returns or something. You're focusing on specific characters, or you're talking about Golden or Silver Age comics and telling behind-the-scenes stories.
I kind of just hop around to whatever is interesting me at the moment. I very much flip from interest to interest in everything. And yeah. I think that comes across in the content that I create, in that I actually don't enjoy keeping up currently that much. Like, I like it and it's fun, but if it's all I'm doing, it kind of starts to feel like a bit of a slog because it's just so much and so much is coming out. And it's fun to highlight those older issues that kind of get pushed by the wayside or people don't know about. There are so many times I do a video and people are like, I didn't even know this happened or that this was a thing and I'm going to go check it out now. That always makes me really happy when I hear that.
Yeah. And it's such a great time for that kind of thing as well, because you have access to some of these older stories with the Comixology, you know, with digital comics. Because, you know, back in the old days, if you wanted to read the Dark Phoenix saga, like, good luck. Like, you had to get a reprint.
You had to go and like flick through all of the
back
files.
Issue. Yep. Yep. And it's really difficult. So that's why I think it's really cool that you talk about Golden and Silver Age characters, because people can actually find those. Do you find that I don't know, like, the demographics of your audience, but are they receptive to hearing about Doll Man or some of the older characters?
I have a very wide split in demographics. So I'm really lucky that way, because you get lots of different viewpoints and opinions that way. Because I have people who are over 70. I have people who are 17. So you get a really wide range. And I find that most people are pretty open to hearing about most things, whether it's an old retrospective on Doll Man or something new, like one of the YA graphic novels and the like.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm somebody who has, like I mentioned before, is reading comics less than I'd really want to these days. But it's also, as you mentioned, just become harder. Like, there's so, like, I remember when, you know, Uncanny X-Men became X-Men and Uncanny X-Men. It's like, okay, two X-Men books. That sounds great, right? Guess what? 10 years later, there's a, you know, 17 X-Men books, and it's impossible to keep up. And I feel, I don't know, you know how it is in fandom. Like, I feel like a phony sometimes, because it's like I want to know exactly what's going on, you know, in the comic zeitgeist, you know, up to date. But it's hard. It's hard to do that. And that's why I like channels like your channel and other comic videos, because you're like, oh, that's what they're doing with DC Rebirth.
Oh, yeah. And right now it's the Omniverse. So all things
are
canon.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Give me a real quick breakdown of what the Omniverse is exactly.
Okay. So the Omniverse is basically DC's attempt to rectify all of its different canons again. And the idea is that with the Omniverse, all things that happened are in play. So anything from past canon can now be picked out and used, and they've kind of done a fusion of certain things. So basically, if you want to use something from like an obsolete canon from forever ago, now it's in play. So basically, you can do it. It's one of those almost Incredibles type things, like when everybody is super, no one is almost. It could go very well, or it could go very poorly.
That's the Brad Bird way of looking at it. It's like a hyper time?
It is. It's very like, it's got a very 0 hour type thing going on.
Okay. All right. I don't feel too lost then, I guess. Do you think that that's a response to like the filmic side of it, like the TV? They're very comfortable with multiverse on DC TV. Mm-hmm. They're kind of getting into that by default in the film side. Do you think that's a response to what they're doing with their filmed properties?
I think so. I think it's a way to easily create synergy, in that if you need to now create a comic or a character that ties back in, you can just do it without having to worry about how does this fit into the pre-existing canon that we have. Like, we need to make it make sense. Yeah. This way, I mean, even though I think people would have accepted it anyway, this way you have an official rationale for why they should accept it. So,
yeah. I'm gonna need that Rick Jones series from you pretty soon, though. I really want to see that.
Rick Jones, everybody's sidekick.
Yeah, everybody's sidekick. You know, we were talking about DC films. With the MCU side opening up to Phase 4 and beyond, do you think that we'll get a Rick Jones or a Cap Wolf or some more obscure characters?
I would love to see something really obscure. I can see them doing Cap Wolf maybe more in an animated type thing and then bringing it to the big screen. I don't know if the world is ready for Cap Wolf. But I think they're diving more into some of their more recent properties is the vibe that I'm getting from like looking at what's being greenlit and the like. So I think that some of the older, more obscure and very niche characters like Rick Jones, Snapper Carr, his DC counterpart, even though he came first, they speak to a very specific, I feel like, time period. And I'm not sure, you would have to update Rick to find some way, like how when they brought Snapper Carr into the animated verse, they made him a reporter. Like you'd have to do something to update the characters. People could be like, oh, that's Rick, but he's not going to be the Rick who was trying to be Bucky, like literally trying to be Bucky.
Right. Yeah, I remember he was in, Bendis put him into Alias, right? As like a folk singer or something like that. So I think it seems like they've, you know, when they first came up with Iron Man 2008 and the phase one of the Marvel Universe, they were kind of mining a lot of that, the Marvel Ultimate stuff and a lot of the recent Bendis storylines, which, you know, is all well and good. Like they weren't my favorite like storylines of Marvel, but I think they did a great job adapting them to films. But now they're almost like going back in time. They're having to reach back into like the 80s and 90s, all the goofy Cap stuff. You know, they promised way back in 2015, they said that Cap 3 was going to be Cap versus the Serpent Society, which never came out. But I never thought we'd see Flag Smasher in any filmic property for Marvel. And here we are.
No, I think they're going to use Disney Plus for that, especially because
those,
from what I've seen, they are going to be like bridges because I can tell they want everything to connect. Like they want you to watch the shows because it's going to tie into like they really are trying to create this giant. It's a gamble. Like, we'll see how long they can pull it off for, how long people can maintain their interest. Like, I'm always happy to see what they're trying to do, but not everything always lands. So
that's true. But, you know, interest and financially, it's pretty much always landed. I wonder what, like, their bloody nose is going to be where they go, okay, I guess we're not going to do that anymore. it kind of happened unfortunately with Mulan, and I don't think Raya did quite as well as Disney was hoping.
No.
But it keeps going on the Marvel side. People seem to love everything they do.
Well, I'm personally excited for Moon Knight. I feel like I'm the only person, but I want to see Moon Knight, so.
Yeah. What's really cool about having Moon Knight now in this integrated universe is that you can do Moon Knight, and then you could have, say, well, they could do Wolverine, I guess, or Captain America, like his alternate personalities. I think that was the Bendis series where he was like hearing Captain America. And,
he was then Spider-Man, all the Avengers and all that stuff.
Yeah, he's like Deadpool, but not fun. He's got all these voices in his head. Well, Star Trek has had a long association with comics going all the way back to the 60s. Have you read a lot of Trek comics?
I have. I actually collect them, but not so much the older stuff, more the recent stuff because they're easier to find. I have a whole collection of Star Trek books and memorabilia and the like. I'm actually reading one right now. It's in my lap while I was waiting. And I used to go around with my dad to stores and just see if there was any Trek stuff and just try and buy it up from used bookstores, like whatever I could get my hand on. So I have a really random, eclectic collection of things.
That's really cool. I love the just awesome fanficky nature of a lot of the Star Trek comics, especially the DC run. I was reading or rereading the DC run from the beginning recently, and I forgot that, like, in one of the first storylines, they have the Excalibians, the rock monsters from the Abraham Lincoln episode, fighting against the Organians from Errand of Mercy. And it's like this, I guess you could just turn your fanfic into a comic script, like that works. doing a Marvel, like making your film or TV franchise like the MCU is the goal of most studios in the current era. Do you see Paramount attempting that with their shows and films?
I'm not sure because it's a difficult sell. And I don't really enjoy what they've done with Star Trek recently in terms of access, because everybody's playing that streaming game right now. Like, we want the service that you are subscribed to. And so because of that, it's made it difficult to access the newer stuff. And so I feel like that's also made it harder to potentially build a giant cinematic universe. And because even though Star Trek is so big, it's also still pretty niche in a way. It's odd. It's like a big niche where it's like people know of it, but not everybody gets as into like the specifics and the depth. So I feel like you can ease people into like an Iron Man or a Batman easier than you can ease them into the complex universe of a Star Trek, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I think they should keep trying though.
I would love them to. There are so many things that I want to see. And I have such a love-hate relationship with the Abrams Star Trek
first. Yeah, you and everybody else, yeah. Something that Trek has always provided that I think is often a tough sell is the more emotional and intellectual side of a action blockbuster extravaganza. You know, you've got... You know, most comic films, or like what's popular these days, Fast and the Furious films, things like that, are these like action extravaganzas. And Star Trek has always been about, you know, the famous, you know, the motion picture. You just look at the ship for 6 minutes and just talk about like, you know, the nature of God and stuff. And something that Marvel has done really well is combine those. It's had really like deep, you know, personal stories and real characters and growth along with the bombast of comic action. And so I think as long as they can continue to go right down the middle of that line and deliver both of those things, they'll succeed. Of course, they announced just recently that they are going to go forward with the Star Trek IV film.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm excited about. You know, I don't hate three. So many people hate three. And I'm like, I don't hate three.
I love three.
What I like about Star Trek movies when they get it really right is when they remember that you're smart. I'm like, as long as you remember that the audience is smart and is willing to sit there and think, like, yeah, they're not going to sit there for 2 hours as everybody has a giant roundtable meeting, you know, in the meeting room. But but as long as you also have those things, because that's part of what is enjoyable about Star Trek, is that it presents you with all of these concepts in a very nuanced fashion and allows you a lot of the times to sit there and absorb it and think about it. Like, one of my favorite things about Wrath of Khan is that there are all these little details just on set, like props and the like, that are there, that if you pick up on them, you're like, oh, that's clever. Like, oh, he's reading Moby Dick and all these things that like lead into the themes. I'm like, I love stuff like that.
Yeah. It's a tale of revenge, but it's also a tale of a guy finding, you know, his first couple of gray hairs and being like, oh boy, I can't do this forever. I know that you have another YouTube channel called Shipper's Guide to the Galaxy. What's the focus of that channel?
That channel is about fandom. It's all about just transformative fandom. So it focuses pretty much on fan fiction and shipping specifically, because I found that it was something that not a lot of people understand, and there's lots of very passionate feelings on all sides. So I wanted to provide a space where I just kind of explain things like, here is the ship, here is what people think about the ship, here is where it came from. Like, just try and like provide a very kind of, if you came in and you had no idea what was going on, you could come away and be like, I understand now. I have feelings one way or the other, but I understand.
Have you ever talked about the Kirk Spock ship?
I have, yeah.
That's awesome.
It didn't do as well as some of the other videos, which was sad, but I love talking about it because some people think that shipping is this new thing that just like exploded with Tumblr. I'm like, it's so old.
Right.
It is so old. And it also plays a pivotal role alongside the development of the con scene. I think it's so important because I'm like, we wouldn't have that type of environment without that alongside of it. I really don't think we would, because that passion that people have for it coming from that avenue and creating all those zines. And I love it. I love that kind of fan enthusiasm and excitement.
Speaking of cons, you know, it's been a long, strange year so far, but fingers crossed. It looks like things may finally be opening up in the world. And one of the things that I love most about fandom is going to conventions, which, of course, COVID totally destroyed in 2020. It's not looking super great for 2021 either. We here at the channel had booked a bunch of cons for 2020. We had planned to just really expand, you know, what we did. And of course, they're all canceled. And it was just loneliness and canceling hotel reservations. Are there cons that you attend regularly?
No, I'm actually an extremely introverted person. So
okay.
I don't get out too much. Like the first cons, I started going a couple of years ago. And yeah. I've always just kind of gone as like a silent observer.
Sure.
Who just kind of wanders around and looks at things and sees people that they'd like to talk to, but doesn't. So yeah, the Barclay episode, Hollow Pursuit, speaks to me in many ways.
Well, that's a great point. You know, is that why you chose this episode to discuss today?
No, it's just, it came down to a toss-up. It was this or Code of Honor. And like, I sat there for a very long time trying to decide. But what swung it in this one's favor for me was I felt it's one of those rare instances of an episode that has aged better. Because lots of times you hear things, you're like, oh, that hasn't aged well. I'm like, actually, I think this has aged and actually is more relevant now in a way than it was when they wrote it. And I find that very fascinating.
We almost made it. I want to do like the balloons and ribbons come down when somebody finally picks Code of Honor, and then we can do that on the show. But this is a great choice nonetheless. And I do think that it has aged well. And I think it speaks a lot to fans and fandom in a similar way to what we were talking about. It's also, you know, it's a great episode. It's in the great season of TNG, the third season. Mm-hmm. And holodeck episodes at this point, you know, now they're run of the mill. We expect to see them in Star Trek, but at this point in the franchise, they're still kind of new. And there's this whole, you know, the whole 2020 joke about fires in California, a worldwide epidemic, white supremacy, computer and program. But they're still kind of figuring out the holodeck at this point. Dixon Hill and Data would bound around as Sherlock Holmes, but this is one of the first episodes where we really border on the psychological as far as the kinds of scenarios that people pick and why they're using the holodeck. And it's definitely the first one where we actually see fake versions of our main characters.
Yes. And they are glorious and wonderful. It's a fun, like, I enjoy that they played clearly with some of the things that people said about the characters and really incorporated that into these holodeck versions, especially with Troi, because it's not her fault. It's just like sometimes the way she's written is very much like, Captain, I'm sensing hostility. So it was funny to see that.
Yeah.
So like for me, what I love about this episode the most is Dwight Schultz as Barclay. I adore his performance of that character. I love that he was a character who came back and had a whole arc. And I love that at the end of his arc, he's not like some uber confident, like up there with the main characters how they present themselves. It felt like a very natural, organic journey. And I love that through him in this episode, you get to see the main crew in another way. Like that's the other reason I like episodes like Lower Decks and the like. It's always interesting to see the people you follow all the time through somebody else's eyes and to have their rough edges kind of highlighted. Because you know that the main bridge crew isn't perfect and the like, but they are very aspirational. So it's very interesting to be able to see them through the eyes of someone who, in my opinion, was more relatable, even though they are playing him like he's very shy and he has a lot of social anxiety and the like, but he's flawed. And lots of the things that happen with him are things that I believe that lots of people can relate to, like just feeling out of place, like not being able to start a conversation, like just feeling more, running through scenarios in your head before they happen, you know, like pretending to have conversations before they happen. There's just so much there that I feel like people can relate to in Barclay.
Yeah. And, you know, so to speak, it's a new frontier for Trek storytelling because, you know, Captain Kirk never had a problem talking to anybody and Spock never had a problem talking to anybody. But yeah, the idea that even in this future, there would be this character who, you know, has relatable problems like we do is really endearing, I think. I should ask you before we move on, have you had a chance to see any of the new Trek series?
Like Discovery?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen some Discovery. I've seen a little bit of Picard. I'm not caught up, again, because CBS All Access, but I've seen some of it. Mm-hmm. What I can, I've seen.
It's, you know, we'll talk about it a little later, but one of the things that I think that we see a lot, especially in things like Lower Decks, is that, like, they're... I like your comment about how this character is kind of, or the characters that we see on the holodeck are possibly a response to fans' reactions to like our main characters. Mm-hmm. And I think that you see that more and more as the franchise has gone on, like they've become more aware of how they're, how the franchise is seen and experienced by the fans. You know, mm-hmm. they're not just writing these crazy sci-fi stories. They're, and Lower Decks is like 100% that. It's like, you know, the characters on Lower Decks are Star Trek fans. Like they've read all the mission logs. They're like, oh, this is like the time that Commander Data, you know, did the thing. And so that sort of wall has, you know, started to dissolve, I think, between the content and the fans. And I think it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. We are talking about the Star Trek Next Generation episode, Hall of Pursuits. It's the 21st episode of the third season of TNG. It first aired on April 30th of 1990. The episode was written by Sally Caves. And Sally Caves is the pen name of Dr. Sarah Higley. Dr. Higley has been a professor of English at the University of Rochester in New York since 1986. She holds a PhD in medieval languages and literature. In addition to Hall of Pursuits, she shares a story credit with Ira Stephen Bear on the first season DS9 episode, Babel. Hailey is the creator of the fictional language Teanoth, and she also built a virtual version of her university's library in Second Life. So she writes what she knows, languages for Babel and virtual worlds for this episode. Sally also coined the term hollow addiction for the series. The episode was directed by Cliff Bohl. We've talked about Cliff recently on the show, but I'll remind listeners that he directed 42 episodes in total of TNG, DS9, and Voyager in his work for the franchise. The stardate for this episode is 43807.4, and your assignment, Sasha, if you can, is to give us a 25-word synopsis of Hollow Pursuits.
25 words. All right, let's keep it brief, and let's see if we can do it. There is a mystery aboard the Enterprise, and the bridge crew need to enlist the help of Lieutenant Barclay to get it solved. Unfortunately, he is a bit socially awkward, and so we experience friction and explore holodiction. How's that?
Perfect. That's great. Here's some interesting facts from the memory banks about the episode, and feel free to jump in with anything you'd like to add. In the holodeck, the Wesley character's costume was based off Thomas Gainsborough's painting The Blue Boy, and the script for the episode makes that connection explicit. And speaking of boys, as Barclay leaves the holodeck at the end of the episode in the last scene, the tune of The Minstrel Boy by Thomas Moore can be heard. The song would return again in the fourth season episode The Wounded as the song sung by Chief O'Brien and his former captain Ben Maxwell. In the episode, Barclay refers to a flux capacitor. This may be a reference to Back to the Future, although it could just as well be a script error, as Wesley refers to a flow capacitor in the previous scene. And speaking of technobabble, the technobabble is in full effect in this episode. There are scenes, especially near the end, where half a dozen guys are just shooting technobabble lines at each other.
Just need to tech all the tech at the
end.
Yeah,
they're doing it the whole time. Yeah. And all the tech is wrong, too. It's none of this is the problem. It's the magnetic quenches, you know, and the fusion pre-burners and the fuel inlet servos are caught in cycle. And the swirl dampers are frozen.
I love that it just comes down to items that we would have no idea about knowing about. They're like, it's these like old things that nobody uses anymore. I'm like, that's great. We could never have solved this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the problem is like they're using, you know, 100-year-old asbestos or something to insulate these tanks, and they don't use that anymore. It's funny because like this, is, I mean, as a Trek fan, I love this, but I feel like this is what people think about when they think about Star Trek dialogue.
They do. I think it is the cliche, and like you hear it all the time, like, Captain, we need to reverse the shield polarity. And like, that's the one that people always go to.
Yeah.
For me, that's not a reason I like this episode is because that stuff is very much secondary. It very much is a character piece and character study. Like, mm-hmm. it's very well mm-hmm. balanced because it is important, because if they don't get all their stuff together, the ship is going to the hull integrity and all of that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The test cylinder props used in the episode were apparently U.S. Navy sonar buoy transport cases. So I guess they made a trip to military surplus for the prop department. And Beverly Crusher only appears as a holodeck character in this episode. She's in it, but never the real Beverly.
This episode also, Dwight Schultz, it was written for him specifically at the behest of Whoopi Goldberg, which I thought was really sweet because they worked together on a movie, and I can't remember the name of the movie, unfortunately, but they're working together on a movie, and it came up that he was a fan of Star Trek, and he thought it was really cool that she was working on the show and that she was playing Guinan. And so she actually went and put in a word with the writers that she thought he was a great actor and that he'd be really good for the show. And they wrote the part specifically for him, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, I bet she never got paid for that either. as a talent scout for the production. Let's talk about the guest stars in this episode. Charlie Lang appears as Duffy. He's the jokey engineer who's unwittingly responsible for the Invidium contamination of the ship. Lang made many appearances on primetime TV in the 80s and 90s. He had recurring roles on the series Dark Skies and Murphy Brown and Days of Our Lives, and he's also appeared in films including Fire in the Sky and Hear No Evil. Whoopi Goldberg, of course, makes one of her appearances as Guinan in the episode. Goldberg appeared 29 times as Guinan in TNG, as well as in Star Trek Generations and Star Trek Nemesis. And I think she's important here. We'll talk about this a little later, but she's on the periphery, but she gives some important perspective on the character of Reg. And of course, Dwight Schultz appears as Barclay in the episode. He's probably best known for playing Barclay on TNG and in Voyager. He's also known for playing Howling Mad Murdoch on the A-Team. And he's a successful voice actor. I didn't know this about him. He has played roles such as Dr. Animo in the Ben 10 series, Chief Mung Dal in the Cartoon Network series Chowder, and Eddie the Squirrel in Cat Dog. Schultz would play Barclay 5 times on TNG, once in Star Trek First Contact, and 6 times on Star Trek Voyager. And yeah, as you mentioned before, apparently he, you know, knew Whoopi Goldberg, who was, of course, on TNG, and got the role that way. The character of Reginald Endicott Barclay III was originally conceived of by Gene Roddenberry, and I was reading, according to Dwight Schultz, the idea behind the character was to present somebody who was relatable to the show's audience. But at the time of the episode's release, there were some viewers who thought that the character of Barclay was presented as a satire of obsessive Trek fans.
Yeah, they thought that they were making fun of them.
Yeah, yeah, which is interesting.
I find that very interesting because this episode, like you mentioned, comes out in 1990. And that was the year I was born. So I didn't see it until years later because the episodes, you know, they're airing out of order, they're in syndication. So
yeah.
I didn't end up seeing it probably until I was maybe 12 or 13 and the like. And so because of that, that would have been like in the 2000s at that point. And right. So that connection for me didn't even happen because I was like, oh, video games. Like that was the first thing that I jumped to. It was like video games and chat rooms and like that kind of thing was where right. it went. So
yeah.
It was very interesting for me when I did like, you know, go on Memory Alpha like years later when that was the thing and like find all of these complaints from people who were like, you're making fun of us and we don't appreciate it. And it was so interesting because it was an angle that I hadn't even considered before up until that point.
Yeah, I don't really remember the backlash at the time. I was probably too young, but I guess I can kind of see it. But at the same time, it's hilarious that this character has become such a long-running character, a character who appears in Voyager more than TNG.
Yeah.
Like that's how popular he was with the fans and with the franchise. It was very important for the creators of the episode that people knew that this was not their intent. Cliff Boyle, the director, said, quote, I didn't feel that, referring to him being a parody of the audience. I would have heard if it was intended. I certainly didn't approach it that way. End quote. And then showrunner Michael Piller later said, quote, it really was not intended directly at Star Trek fans. More than any other character in the 3 years I have been at Star Trek, the character of Barclay was more like me than anyone else. My wife watched that show and saw what was going on and said, yeah, that's you, because I'm constantly in my family fantasy world. And Ira Steven Bear, who did a rewrite in the episode script, said on the TNG Season 3 Blu-ray that he added that line that Barclay says about standing in the corner, trying to look comfortable examining a potted plant, because that was something that Piller had said to Ira Steven Bear about himself shortly after Bear joined the writing staff. So, you know, calm down, Trekkies of the past. I guess people were still sore about the Get a Life Shatner sketch on SNL.
Well, we Trekkies have always been a prickly bunch, and we still are. So.
little bit self-conscious, yeah. You know, it's interesting to me that one of the things that makes Trek Trek is the diehard fan base. And the franchise, I don't know, that maybe they're getting better with some of these later series, but they've never been able to really connect with that idea on screen. So much so that Galaxy Quest beat them to it, you know? And of course, everybody loves Galaxy Quest.
Yes, Galaxy Quest is great.
Yeah, the way that it kind of like, you know, good-naturedly pokes fun at fandom. So, I don't know, maybe Star Trek fans, you know, can have a sense of humor about themselves when it's not Trek itself telling the jokes. You know, we've got the Orville now. And like I said, you know, Lower Decks is, I think, basically a show about Star Trek fans.
I'm going to need to check it out, but it's like I had a baby recently, so it's very difficult to do.
Oh, congratulations.
Anything. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, when you get a little more free time 18 years from now, go check it out. before they decided on Trials and Tribulations as being the 25th anniversary DS9 episode, Ronald D. Moore actually wanted to do an episode where the crew of DS9 visits Sigma Iota 2, the gangster planet from A Piece of the Action. But only now, like 100 years later, everybody is an obsessed Starfleet fan. Because they left a, you know, communicator behind before. And it's like the Galaxy Quest planet. And I wonder if the fear of the fans being offended maybe, you know, cooled their enthusiasm for that idea.
I can imagine the show, like, so, because I remember watching a documentary, I think it was Fanboys or the like, and it's very easy to get people up in arms. So I can see them shying away, especially if you have episodes like Hollow Pursuits, where that isn't the intent at all and it's being taken that way. So if that's the case, then if you are actually going to do something that's going to lampshade or lampoon a little bit, I would be concerned.
I think of all shows, though, I think Trek could probably handle it the best. Whenever you watch an episode, these procedural shows like Bones or whatever, there's an episode where they go to a con and everybody's, you know, goofy and they're making fun of like nerds, or like the entire existence of Big Bang Theory. Like, maybe they're not, maybe Trek could handle it the right way. But of course, we've got Galaxy Quest. So
I think it's hard because also when you are working on it, there's a personal stake in it. Like, you're passionate about it too. And so I think that comes through. Like, for example, Supernatural has a very interesting evolution of this, because I remember their first Khan episode was very mean-spirited. It was very much like, these people are losers, what are they doing? They had a character, Becky, who was this shipper and fangirl, and she was just like this loser, and everybody made fun of her, and she was obsessed, and it was just really mean-spirited. But then as they got more into the Khan scene themselves, years later, when they do and introduce more characters who are fangirls and the like, they're much kinder about it. But again, it was because all of this stuff is coming at you. Like, you're getting all these messages. And these days, it's easier to send creators messages now than ever. And so you can end up getting some like really awful or mean messages yourself. And then it can be hard because we're all human to not react to that, to not be like, okay, well, screw you. You know, I'm going to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to look at yourself, or at least people's idea of yourself, which we definitely see our crew dealing with in this episode. I'm somewhat familiar with Supernatural. Did these episodes involve like that guy who's like writing the books that like are the show?
Okay, yes. Okay. They go to a con and he's there like writing the books. And later on in the series, he turned out to be God. It got Supernatural more complicated.
Well, that was all after Kripke left, so it doesn't count. Well, obviously, this episode is all about Barclay, frozen swirl dampers or no. And Barclay represents something I'm beginning to feel more and more is one of the most important parts of Trek. And that is the idea of it being relatable to its audience. You know, Barclay is not, he's not phasering Klingons. He's not taking girls home from 10 forward or giving orders to the whole ship. He can barely speak up in a meeting. And that's relatable. Like, he is who we would be in this world. I'm in this episode and I don't like it.
I think that he also provides a good balance, because I think a part of Trek is aspirational. I think it always should be. I think that the optimism of Trek is part of what makes it so unique in sci-fi, where it's such a dystopian landscape across the board. Then you have something like Trek that's like, but we can be awesome. So it's really nice to have that as well. But it's important to have characters like him, because otherwise it does become like you can start making fun of those main characters because they become unrelatable if they don't have characters like Barclay to balance them out. So it's important to see people like that. And I think that he's a bit ahead of his time, because when he's having a conversation with Geordi in 10 forward after Geordi has caught him in the holodeck and seen the program, and it's great that it's Geordi, because Geordi, of course, fell in love with that girl on the holodeck.
Yeah. So
he can relate like more to what's going on, and they have that conversation, and it's just so amazingly human and a really connective moment where he has that speech about how he can't talk to people and how, you know, he wishes that he could. And it's just something that really always stuck with me. And the other scene that stuck with me from this forever, and I think it probably always will, is after his second breakdown, where he retreats to the holodeck and they all go get him, so like Riker, Troy, and Geordi. And he's there talking to Jordan. He's like, the people I create in there are more real to me than the people out here. Yeah. And that was just such a profound statement because it's something that I feel like a lot of people can relate to, especially now when you have all of these parasocial encounters where you can see, where you can kind of craft yourself, craft the person that you want to be, not just in something like Second Life or in a video game, but even with a social media persona. And I can see it being very appealing to retreat there. So in that way, I feel like Barclay is more relevant than ever.
It's always been, I think you're right that it's a balance between the aspirational nature of Trek and making the characters relatable. I mean, like the characters of Trek, like Kirk, you know, so happy to say or to distance himself from the predations of 20th century humans. And Picard's always talking about how greed and want have been eliminated in the future. And I think that that is important. Yeah, that aspirational side of it is important. But sometimes it leaves the characters of Trek feeling distant or alien to us. And, you know, anybody that reads that much Dickens and listens to that much opera, that's a snob, right?
There's a really great Picard scene in this, at least for me. It's a very painful scene, but they have that nickname that Wesley, like little bratty Wesley has given to Barclay, which is broccoli. And they tell it to Picard in that meeting. And he's like, no, we shouldn't do that. That's wrong. But then later he accidentally calls him that on the bridge. And it's so painful. But I think it's also an important moment because it shows that Picard's always trying. Like he's trying to be a leader. He's trying to be that person that you aspire to be, but he's still a person. He still slips up. He's still like, he thought that was funny. He just, you know, couldn't show it. And then it accidentally slipped out.
He had to be the boss in that moment. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's really funny. I've always felt okay being a little alienated from the characters on Trek. Same. You know, they feel like aliens sometimes. I know they're human, but they feel like, they're future people. If they unthaw a country singer from the 20th century, there should be a communication problem there. But as Trek has continued as a franchise into the 21st century, I think it's become more important to make the characters more relatable. I think younger audiences are really wanting to see themselves in these characters and relate to their struggles. You know, every character has a little Barclay in them now on shows like Discovery and Picard. And if you could check out Lower Decks, like Lower Decks is basically about a Barclay type character trying to, you know, not be that way. And another character who is self-consciously like an amazing action hero because she's worried that she is kind of a Barclay. Mm-hmm. And I think that's you know, in across all genre media, that's like 100% the way that things are going. If you watch something like, I don't know, Space 1999 or like Seven or something like that, like these characters are cool, but you could never be as cool as these characters. But now you can see yourself in characters like Tilly and even a character like Michael Burnham, who is awesome, but like starts from such a low point after having, you know, kind of screwed up and having to sort of build her reputation and her career back.
Like I like that stuff, but I could always relate to the older characters because I don't feel that they were perfect. Like I know that they present themselves that way and stuff, but they did have flaws and I feel like they were accessible, but I feel like you had to want to get into their shoes. But I feel like that's part of the aspirational nature. Like you have to want to be like them, but they do have these flaws. Like, I mean, Geordi, the cringe of falling in love with that girl on the holodeck and then meeting her and then kind of, you know, that's still being there. Like that's a very human thing. Or even there was a great episode with Riker that also I was flirting with, where he ends up meeting his transporter clone and you have to deal with like the path not taken and the like. So I feel like sometimes people pedestal these characters more than they actually were. Even with Picard, you're dealing with the fact that he does feel disconnected and isolated. There are some of those episodes where he tries to connect with people and connect with the crew and can't. Because he feels like he needs to be distant from them. So I think that sometimes in the attempt to reconcile the fact that people want things to be more relatable, there's a bit of a dismissal of the fact that in ways they already were. Like one of the most relatable characters to me ever was Spock. And some people view him as like this absolute pinnacle, but I always saw so much to relate to in him. So I feel like there is a lot of things already there to relate to and that it's not necessary to make every character quote unquote relatable, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I hadn't considered that, you know, I saw a lot of these episodes when I was so young and that maybe that's behind my kind of hagiography of seeing these characters as being these, you know, amazing adults doing these amazing things, and I could never be like them. But that's a very interesting perspective, I think. Somebody who does not feel like he fits there is Mr. Barkley.
Yeah.
The show doesn't really get specific about Barkley medically or psychologically, but I'm sure that many viewers who aren't neurotypical would relate to Barkley's struggles.
I think so. This is a way that I feel like he's a bit ahead of his time, because they just describe him as shy. They're like, oh, you're just shy.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, too, because one of the things I really enjoy about this episode is that it allows you to sit in the space of all the different reactions that people have to Barkley. And you have Jordy, who doesn't like him and is just like, oh, I hate being around him. Like, it's frustrating and it's difficult. Yeah. And, you know, like, I don't want to. But again, that's a character flaw on his part. And that makes him interesting. Like, oh, I don't want to put the effort in. Like, this guy's difficult. And I feel like that's relatable to people too. Like, we've all had people in our lives who seem kind of awkward and you're like, oh, like, I don't really want to. But then you see the reward of what happens when you go and get to know that person, that Jordy and Barkley actually have a lot more in common than they think, and probably more than Jordy would like because of the opinion that he had of him. And then you have someone like Riker who, he can be a bit of a jerk. And this episode allows him to be a jerk and be presented that way, which isn't something that always happens. Like, a lot of times you're supposed to think that Riker's always in the right. But when I was watching as a kid, I sometimes felt he's a bit of a bully. Like, he's kind of mean
sometimes,
the way he comes down on people. So I thought it was really cool to have somebody kind of call him out and be like, no, he is rude and a bully. Like, he's the way he just wants him transferred. You're like, oh, he's difficult. Transfer him to mothership. That guy who gave him a good recommendation was clearly lying. Like, it's
Yeah.
And but I also like that he's there, because the reaction he has when he sees the holodeck and these versions of themselves is also very human. He's angry. He's like, delete this program right away. This is an invasion of privacy.
Yeah, touched a nerve. Yeah.
And I feel like that's important too, because that's something that also needs to be negotiated in a world where you can create images of people. What's the rules around that? Like, what are the optics? Like, what are the ethics surrounding that? Like, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it really is, because we've talked a lot about the holodeck on the show, but we've never really had an episode where we've tried to sort of break down how the holodeck is seen in their society or sort of managed, or even just like the metaphysical kind of aspects of a box where you can create literally anything, you know, in the world. And as far as like Riker goes, it's funny because it's sort of like, you know, glass holodecks, because you know that as soon as he's like, I'm disgusted by all of this, he's going to turn around and go delete like his history, because
God knows
what he's up to in the holodeck.
Well, because he also fell in love with that girl on the holodeck in season one.
That's right.
In the binary episode, because they accidentally create the character who is very real, and he connects with her, and he even goes back at the end and tries to see her, but she's not the same. And so he ends up leaving and he's disappointed. But you know that he was going to try and kind of maybe continue something on there. So it's like, it's interesting that his critique is more that it's because it's them. You know, it's because it's versions of them. It's a really short version of him, which is funny.
Yeah, this episode actually ends up, you know, I realized that watching this episode after a long time, most of my questions about the holodeck, or at least the holodeck in the TNG era, are discussed or answered in this episode. You know, I always wondered if people have trouble distinguishing between reality and fantasy. You know, obviously, yes, we see that in the episode. Are there rules about making copies of real life people? Not at this point, but you can tell that people are particularly skeeved out by the idea. Mm-hmm. You know, they're almost like, oh, wow, he did that. Like, I would now, you know, I do stuff in the holodeck, but I would never do that. You know, and has anybody ever thought of the holodeck as a therapeutic tool? I mean, Jordy points that out in this episode, that what Reg is doing is in its own way, you know, therapeutic. It's not therapy. He's kind of cosplaying therapy, but he's still trying to have a therapeutic experience by, you know, these experiences that he's having in the holodeck.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, I think it makes sense why he wouldn't have sought Troy out for a couple of reasons. Like, one, because he does have all that social anxiety and is having a hard time because it's being exacerbated by the fact that the crew isn't shy about the fact that they don't like him. Like, it's not like they're hiding it. So obviously that's making it worse. But on top of that, he has that attraction to Troy. So she would be extra hard to, but that was always something I always wondered, because she did go on to treat him. I'm like, are there no other counselors? Because this seems like a bit of a conflict.
Yeah, she has a staff. Right, yeah.
Like, maybe one of them should be doing this, given, you know, he made her the goddess of empathy in his holodeck program.
Yes. Yeah, it's a great, it's one of the cool things, storytelling wise about the holodeck, is that what you can do with it in terms of fake outs. And they use that really well in this episode, where the first time you think, okay, obviously Reg has gone to seek some therapy here, and then it's a fake out. No, it's just his idealized version of therapy, which then sets up, of course, when he actually goes to therapy, and you understand even more why it would be off-putting for him. Because God knows what he's done in that therapist office in the holodeck. But, you know, she asks him, like, have you ever been with a counselor? Yes. No, I haven't. Yeah.
Also, I remember watching that episode when I was younger and just really connecting with him, because all the things she's doing were making me more uncomfortable. Like, would you like the lights down? Would you like to lie? I'm like, no, stop, please.
Yeah, the intimacy is a little strange. Yeah. You know, you mentioned before Jordy, and I think that he is a really important character in this episode, even though he's not the focus. And the way that, like, it's, you know, he's been the chief engineer for a little while now, but we're still kind of seeing him be a boss in this world. And I love the episode, I love the scene in the episode where they're around the pool table in engineering, and he's like, okay, everybody, come on, give me your ideas. You know, what do we got here? And he has to, the mentoring that he's getting from Riker as a boss is, you know, get rid of this guy, get this guy out of here. But he has to approach it in a different way.
You really get to see the contrast between Picard and Riker's styles here too, where Riker is very much like, oh, the ship has this standard, and if people don't meet it, like, well, too bad, get off. But Picard's like, well, you should try and raise him to the standard. Like, maybe it's something you're doing. And I enjoy that that's brought up. And Guinan brings it up too, that maybe the problem isn't only him. Like, maybe the problem is also his environment and how people are treating him. And you do see that when people do reach out and make the effort, it makes a huge difference, because they ask the question, like, well, how did he even get through the academy? And then, so as a viewer, at least I was like, well, he obviously made it. So, you know, if he made it, he had the chops. Yeah. So it must be something going on here.
Yeah, I love the little note or comment that by Riker, that, like, because Picard's like, we're on the Enterprise here. This is the best ship. I mean, he must be good. He's here. And look at his review. All of his supervisors, you know, five stars. And Riker's like, they may have oversold that because they were trying to, like, move him on. Yeah. I like that idea that, like, it's not Barclay's fault, but, like, this Peter principle has sort of, like, elevated him now to the Enterprise. But Picard is a commander who's not going to let the buck stop. He's like, no, we're going to shape this guy up. And to do that, don't, like, you know, have him scrubbing floors. Be his friend. Get to know him. Get to understand him. And Geordi is, of course, the right boss for that, because Geordi is a good person, I think, at heart. And he does that. He goes, okay, I'm going to talk to this guy. And what really helps him is Guinan. I always love when Guinan is in an episode, even when she's dressed like a French's mustard bottle, like she is in this episode. And I like that she tells him what she tells him about herself, how she's never felt like somebody who fits in really is either. And the story of her uncle Turkim, who was a really warm guy, but you had to take the time to get to know him.
Mm-hmm. No, it's so important, because Guinan is often there to present a different perspective, and it really works here. But I feel like this episode is unique in that it gives you so many different perspectives. It even has a good Wesley moment. And I know some people are down on Wesley. I actually really like Wesley. And I ended up being sad by the time he was shipped off, because I think lots of the problems with Wesley stem with how he's written in the first season. And as soon as they stop writing him like a Mary Sue or a Gary Sue, and they start actually making him a character, I think he really comes into his own. And even in this episode, like, the things he's doing, like, yeah, they're annoying, but he's 17. Like, you know, like, he's 17. Like, yeah, of course he made up like a kind of mean nickname for this guy, and he stepped over him because, like, he doesn't realize what he's doing. Like, when he steps over him in the meeting, he's like, oh no, like, you should do it like this. He doesn't realize that he's being rude or really crushing him, because he doesn't have the experience yet. But at the same time, Barclay's vision of him is equally valid and also lines up with, you know, your past experiences with Wesley, where he has been kind of snotty and like, I'm saving the whole ship, even though I'm drunk. It's season one. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's funny, too. He's a great foil, I think, for Barclay because, you know, he's a golden boy. His mm-hmm. dad was in Starfleet and he's a genius and yada, yada, yada. And Dwight Schultz was 43, I think, when he first played Barclay. And the ranks are always a little screwy on Star mm-hmm. Trek, but he's only made junior grade lieutenant. And we don't know a lot about his background, but I'm sure that his problems speaking up have hurt his chances at promotion. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this adult character with, you know, who's not neurotypical and he's got his own problems. And then you've got this little kid, like you said, who's, you know, 17, he's young, dumb, and full of something. And I love that scene where he's trying to, Barclay's trying to get his stuff out. And Wes is like, nope, not it. Nope, that's not it. That's not it. Come on, let's go. Yeah. It's a great contrast between like two different characters.
That's one of the cool things about Barclay is that he plays so well off of all the people. Like sometimes they have, you know, guests really right on characters and it doesn't always hit. But I find that he plays well off of everybody, even the people he's supposed to be antagonistic against, like Riker. It's great to see that because, again, like Riker's not my fave. So it is nice to see that his style doesn't work with everybody. It is nice to see that the different people in the different ranks have different styles and the way they engage matters. And it can bring out, you can bring people up or it can bring people down. So.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, naturally for a character like Barclay, who has access to something like the holodeck, that would definitely be a tempting thing to sort of escape into the ultimate dream womb.
Yeah.
And it, Hollow Addiction, would, which was, you know, created for this episode, I think would definitely be a thing in the future. And people forget that, especially at this point in TNG, the holodeck is very new. It's mm-hmm. easy to forget that when we first see the holodeck in Encounter and Farpoint, everybody is blown away by this thing. I think it's safe to assume they had some kind of holographic entertainment before, but this is a whole new paradigm of virtual reality. Like Riker is, the rocks in the water, you know, are blowing Riker
away. Yeah, like this completely immersive experience. It's just something unique and different. And I like that because I feel like it would be, you would have these emerging problems with it, like things you mm-hmm, hadn't mm-hmm. ever thought about. And all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, people could just be in here all the time and never leave.
Yeah, forget World of Warcraft. Like this is, yeah, people would be here forever. It'd be a whole new field of psychology, I'm sure.
It's one of the more interesting uses for it too. And I find that all of Reg's episodes find an interesting use for the technologies in play. I think, is the next one the one where he shows up where he has the hypochondria and the transporter and the things are in the transporter?
No, the next one is the Nth Degree, I believe, where he gets, becomes brain. A super genius.
Yeah.
I actually like that one, I think, a little more than this one in terms of its resolution, because it's cool. I like the fact that we don't have to, like, fix or change Barclay for him to help save the day. It's just about including him in this one. Mm-hmm. But I like the Nth Degree a little more in that it's literally his... It's fixing that problem that becomes the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, he gets the laser shot in his head or whatever.
It's very like Flowers of Algernon kind of thing.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Like... Yeah. He becomes a lot smarter and a lot more confident. And of course, Dwight Schultz gets to play both a confident Barclay and Cyrano de Bergerac because Crusher's directing one of her plays again. But then, like, him being different and changing becomes the real problem there. And it's like, no, it's dangerous. We don't want you to be like that. We want you to be the Barclay we know, and we can accept you and handle you that way. I think it's just thematically, I think it fits a little more than just, oh my God, asbestos, alien asbestos is in the ship and it's going to blow up in 30 seconds.
What I like about that is not like the whole magical item that they just found, but the fact that it's because he views things differently than them that he's able to see it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they're all stuck in, you know, like their same thought patterns. And he's the only one who can get outside of it to think of something that's truly something that none of them would have considered.
Because he's imaginative. Yeah, like Guinan says. And so they put on the Michael Jackson gloves and get the black light and, and look at the canisters. Yeah. just like apropos of nothing, I wanted to talk about LeVar Burton's amazing stunt fall in this episode. In the very... opening scene when Barclay is going nuts and 10 forward, he pushes Geordi back and he does this, whoa, and then he does like a full backflip over a chair. And
it was
one take, it's all LeVar Burton. Yeah. I'm surprised they let him do that, but that's a talented guy. He should definitely host Jeopardy.
I was rewatching it just this morning, actually, just to make sure that I remembered absolutely everything. Because I watched it earlier in the week, and I was like, no, I need to see it again. And my daughter was there, and she saw that scene, and now Jordy's her favorite. Like, now he's
yeah, oh, really? They got to get more tumbling on this show. Get the kids in here. I think it's really interesting that a couple episodes after this, there's an episode called Transfigurations, where a strange alien comes on board that turns out to be an energy being. And very early in the episode, there's this weird technology that they never use in Star Trek again, where you put a thing on a healthy person's brain and it helps regulate an injured person's brain. And they do this. And because this guy is an energy guy, a little zap goes into Geordi. Mm-hmm. And for the first part of the episode, we see Geordi go from being Geordi, nice guy, not getting all the chicks, to like being really confident and finally like, you know, making it happen with Christy Henshaw. And I wonder if that was an effect of the Barclay character being introduced and also being kind of successful with them going, well, we don't need Geordi to be a guy who lacks confidence anymore. Like, he's going to go on and be our chief engineer for the next couple seasons. Mm-hmm. And we have Barclay now for those kind of storylines. Because it always kind of weirded me out that nobody ever talked about that time that Geordi got like a brain boost. Like, it just becomes part of his character. And it, like, you know, Barclay was on the ship. They should have ran down and grabbed Barclay and went, ooh, zap this guy too.
I feel like season three is very much a transition season. You can feel some of the tones and themes evolving. I feel like this is the season where you start to really see the crew come into their own as people. All of their traits, I feel, fully kind of coalesce, except for Troy. I feel Troy takes the longest to coalesce as the series goes on. But everybody else kind of finds a balance and an even keel. Because this is the Sarek season as well. Because you see a lot of development with Geordi in this season. Because the holodeck thing just keeps coming up for him this season. It's why, it's like Wesley calls him out on it and Sarek and all of that. So I feel like he goes through a lot in this season as well. So it's fascinating because I feel they grow. I feel that they grow a lot. Like, if you watch them in the first season and then you see them at the end, there's been significant growth, which is also another reason why I feel that they are relatable. Because for me, if they were purely aspirational, they wouldn't move. They would just be archetypes that kind of stayed in place. But by the end of it, they're all a little different. They're all a little different than they were when you started.
Sure. And I'm sure a lot of that's down to Michael Piller taking over as showrunner and head writer and just doing like course correcting. You know, we've had a show that's been on for 2 years now. Let's fix what we can fix and find new directions for the character. This is also where, of course, the finale of the season is the fantastic Best of Both Worlds. Yes. But that's where Riker really starts to get an arc, which never really completes. They set Riker up as like, come on, Riker, why don't you want your own command? You got to get out there. You're afraid. And that just continues until the end of TNG and Nemesis. Like, he finally gets a command. But
they set him up for an impossible arc because he can't leave.
They do. Yeah. And in another universe where Patrick Stewart didn't sign his contract, he would have been gone and Riker would have become the new captain. And I think that, you know, Best of Both Worlds is a fantastic story. It didn't give us the Borg, but it gave us the Borg as like a serious threat. But it kind of like the sacrifice was Will Riker as a character, I think. He just sort of kind of settles in as that guy that's around.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Will Riker, but who knows where it could have gone if Picard only would have just died already. Well, as we get to the end here, is there anything that you've left unsaid? Anything that you still wanted to talk about as far as Hollow Pursuits goes?
Not that I can think of. Just that it's a really great layered episode. And every time I rewatch it, I find that there is something new or some new small detail that I find that I enjoy. And it's also one of those rare episodes where I feel like the Blu-ray hasn't hurt it significantly. There are some episodes where they've upgraded it to Blu-ray and they're like, oh no, just like put it back. Like, we don't need to see that, put it back. The effects look really bad. But this one, it's really solid. And it's also fun to see the actors get to dress up as the Musketeers and do all the fun period piece things. So it's got so many elements. I feel like there are just so many different elements in this story to enjoy. And it really showcases and highlights the things that Trek can do outside the techie tech, because people think of like tech all the tech, and that's there, but there's so much more. And I feel like this episode is a good example of that.
Isn't that what holodeck episodes are really for? To let the actors, you know, screw around and play musketeers and detectives. I know Brent Spiner always likes to get out and do something besides just not blink and not use contractions. I think that's a really great point that you made about the episode. And I also think that, like, this is the kind of story that TNG in seasons 4 and beyond would get a lot better at telling. The kind of story that's a personal story where something is going on and you don't need Romulans or, like, energy beings or something happening. You know, they do kind of cram that, oh my God, the ship's going to blow up into the last act. But I think in later seasons, they would just kind of drop that and you would just... let you know, like Data's day or something like that, you know, the episodes where like Data's dating somebody, or you would just let that conflict sort of play out, and maybe there'd be an alien thing going on, but there doesn't have to be a catastrophe every week on the ship.
And I love it because it makes the world feel bigger, like it makes it feel more complex, and that's like, because DS9 is my favorite one, and that was one of my favorite things about it, is that it feels like a world you could be in, and I feel like episodes like this help with that. And that's why I feel like that balance needs to be struck, because with some of the Discovery episodes I've seen, I worry that it's veering too far into the almost drama territory, because there is a balance that needs to be, a fine line to be walked, because the world is so big that you can do something like Discovery and Picard because you have all that space, but it's always important to remember the foundations, because you can't get too far off of them. So it's just, when you have a franchise that's gone on for this long, it's such an interesting balancing act. And because you have so many different fans coming from so many different eras, it makes it a very interesting experience.
Discovery can get really breathless sometimes. And I wonder if it is an effect of having less episodes, where they feel like they really have to get to the point.
Well, I also feel like it's a change in storytelling, because as TNG goes on, like you all, like this was very episodic. This is an episodic series. DS9 is episodic for most of it, but then it starts to arc. So, and it's like, it gets more and more continual arcs until by the end of season 7, it's like all arc. But like, you still have those moments to breathe. Like you can have an episode like Data's Day that's just like, what's Data doing today? And I feel like those episodes are fun and important, and they help make your world feel more cohesive. But I mean, you can't do that when you have like 10 episodes. You don't have time to have Data do like stuff. Yeah.
That's why I really like some of the short treks, because a lot of them were just like something that's happening to a character and it is, you know, it's setting something else up, but it's also a more relaxing kind of look at their world, making their world seem more real. Well, now that we're at the end of the episode, let's talk My Space Dad Can Beat Up Your Space Dad. Who's your favorite captain and why?
My favorite captain is actually Picard. It's I love Picard because I am a big fan of the Picard speech. I love the like soliloquies and Picard speeches, and also because he feels very competent and rational in a crisis. And I feel like that's very important to have in a leader of this giant intergalactic space vessel that's going to encounter Lord knows what. Even when a situation was out of hand, it always felt like Picard could handle it. And that's one of the things I really liked. Kirk's kind of, I like all of them, but Kirk's very like cavalier and kind of devil may care. And so sometimes I was kind of worried, like this is just going to devolve into Lord knows what. Sisko, I didn't mind being a commander. Like, I didn't mind when they promoted him to captain either, but he was kind of laissez-faire, especially in the first season. I remember the episode where Bashir and Garak want to go down to the planet. They show up in the middle of the night and they're like, can we take a runabout? And he's like, yeah, sure. And I'm like, wow.
Dad, I want the keys.
And Voyager's interesting. Like, Voyager's an interesting experience. And I like Janeway, but sometimes she can be a little harsh. And some of the decisions she makes, I'm like, yikes. So that's just a personal thing. And Archer brought his dog to a negotiation. So Archer brought his dog to first contact. So
the privileges of rank, I guess. Here at the end of the show, you'll receive a commission and the rank of ensign. What department on the ship do you work in?
I work in the medical department.
Interesting.
Despite my yellow shirt that nobody can
see. Any specific field that you would work on?
I think I would work in the cellular regeneration and the examination of degenerative diseases in the future.
Interesting. Interesting. Something that I think as you run into more and more alien pathogens would definitely have to be important.
It stems back to that first episode that I ever saw, Too Short a Season, because you have that Admiral and he does have that condition. And it's one of the few times that it's acknowledged. I mean, they do it later in Discovery. So what they, it's one of the few times that they acknowledge that you still have diseases. Because one of the things you hear about Star Trek all the time is that we've eliminated all of the But they, those things still exist. They're just different. So I thought that was an interesting exploration of that.
The amount of specialties that there must be in the future must be insane, you know, with 1,000 worlds or something in the Federation. Their doctors are on like Wikipedia all the time. Is this the right thing? And I always wonder about the really weird procedures that you get. Like, do you learn in Starfleet Medical School how to like cantilever somebody's spine out of their body like they do with Worf in that one episode, or is that something that you have to just sort of like cook up on your own?
There's an episode where Bashir replaces that entire medic's brain, like, or he was going to, he replaces half. He's like, I can replace the other half, but he wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we gave him a robot, half a robot brain. Do you want a full one, or that'll be extra. Well, Anson Wood, thanks for joining me to talk about Star Trek and the Star Trek universe. If people want to continue the conversation, and they can, at EISTpod on Twitter and the Enterprising Individuals Facebook page, where can people find you online?
They can find me at Casually Comics on YouTube and anywhere else on Casually Comics, or if they're interested in fandom and shipping, they can find me at Shippers Guide to the Galaxy.
Well, thanks again for joining me, and we are signing off until the next mission. Hailing frequencies closed.
I'm Mikan Hanna.
And I'm Caliban.
I am a huge Sailor Moon fan. I've been a Moonie since the beginning. I've seen every episode, every movie. I've read all the manga. I love it.
I've got a head full of bad wiring, and I've never seen a single episode.
Do you want to join the wonderful world of Sailor Moon?
Okay. Enter laughing. It's hard to believe that that was us. It feels like ancient history.
We recorded that a few minutes ago.
Ancient history, but now that I'm a Sailor Moon expert.
You're not an expert?
But I'm trying!
Every week on Sailor Noob, we talk about a new episode of the original Sailor Moon series.
It's all new to me.
And I'm a little more seasoned. I've been a Japanese language student, and I've lived in Japan.
And you use your experiences to talk about the food, fashion, and culture of every episode of Sailor Moon.
What do you do again?
Share in the wonder of a classic anime series.
Good enough. Sailor Noob is a great companion for first-time watchers, and it is a fun hit of nostalgia for the experienced fan.
You can catch the show every Friday wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr, posting all things Sailor Moon.
One day I shall be the master.
Let's just get through this series first.
Okay.